You're listening to Gilder 4 Radio, broadcasting live across the swamp, the hive, outlands, and the far reaches of the Ash Wave.
Hey everyone, welcome to Gildersford Radio, broadcasting live deep from the heart of Gildersford's notorious Eastgate Docks. I'm Lee, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Dixie, Roscoe, Lawrence, and Gaz.
Well, hello there, old friends, hive scum, ash waste drifters, and perhaps even a few uphivers. What's been occurring in Gildersford this past month? Well, in a nutshell, stuff all, really. With the end of the Ashgate campaign, the regular members of Gildersford have scattered like nomads into the dunes. A few games in the hive have been occurring, mainly for some newer members getting up to speed, but largely folks have been using the time to attend to the game systems. With Games Workshop seemingly focused 100% on 10th edition 40k right now, there has been zero Necromunda releases this month. Really? Seems like not a lot to be discussing. However, fear not, we've got some great Gildersford lore that we've been planning and promising for a long time. That's right, we're going to be doing the full lowdown on the primary antagonist for Gildersford, Gangrene. We've been absolutely inundated with submissions for the Sack of Whack, and that's been mainly from our friend Adam. However, we've had a particularly tasty Delac stack that we'll be dissecting this month. And closing out, the community have posted some fantastic questions in our chat about handling how totally different playstyles are dealt with in the same campaign. How do you cope with pure narrative versus pure whack players, and what sort of balance and spin does that bring to a campaign? If that sounds interesting, secure that grox and settle in for a great episode.
Well, it's that time of the month again, and we're very happy to have you all along, dear listeners. It's time to introduce everyone. So say hello, Dixie.
Hello.
Say hello, Lawrence.
Hello.
Say hello, Roscoe.
I'll do.
Say hello, Lee. Hello, Lee. Well, unfortunately, Gaz can't be with us tonight. Real life has got in the way and all of that jazz. But instead of that, this month, we have a very special guest joining us. Say hello, Justin.
Hello.
Now, how is everyone, considering that there's been stuff all Necromunda going on recently?
Well, I've been doing some other stuff other than Necromunda, but you know, we had the end of our campaign, which was, you know, quite intense. So it was nice to take a break. But we've got a game coming up that Roscoe is organising, which I'm looking forward to. Roscoe, do you want to tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah, by all means. So this will be a second run of a homebrew scenario I came up with called Into the Depths. I think I mentioned it in a previous episode, actually, because it's an homage to everyone's favourite Jennifer Lopez starring Anaconda. So some gang leaders and some bounty hunters will be heading into the depths of a partially flooded cistern to see if they can't take out this giant Xenos snake that's been eating work crews.
So bad it's good.
Last time it was famously taken out by an incredibly drunk lady by, was it her name, Polly James?
I cannot remember. I think she was so drunk, nobody was quite understood, quite sure what she was shouting. But yeah, she downed several bottles of Wild Snake and Second Best, and then just went head to head with it, and it was very entertaining.
And head to head is the operative word, because I think she took it out with a headbutt, didn't she?
She did take it out with a headbutt, yes.
So yeah, I'm for my part, I'm very much looking forward to running that sort of multiplayer chaos again. It'll be a really nice opportunity to get some of our newer players in on the ground and give them a run through the basic rules with a little bit of extra spice added.
Yes. And it's nice. It's a nice one because it kind of sets about who we are as a group as well, because it's very fluffy, very narrative. You know, you can bring some of the powery stuff, which again we're going to talk about later, but it doesn't necessarily help you in this scenario when you've only got two fighters.
Yeah, absolutely. You famously brought, it's very on brand, but you brought Chemdart's toxin weapons, didn't you, Lawrence? Which
I did. I tried to tranquilize it to sleep. It didn't work.
and then it ate you.
And then it ate me. Well, no. To be fair, it ate Bates, my scummer. That was kind of his job.
Scabs and Cal Jericho.
Yeah, no. His name was Bait. and his job was to attract the thing in range, because the range on a needle rifle isn't actually all that long. And then I tried to put it to sleep and it didn't work, so I ran away.
No. What was Dixie, what have you been up to?
Well, just because we're not playing Necromunda doesn't mean that my brain can stop arbitrating in any way, shape or form. So I've been ticking away at various bits and pieces. I've been working on sort of campaign stuff. Lots of real life work and historical reenactment stuff going on, and a bit of 28 mil historical gaming in the background as well. But yeah, I'm thinking ahead now to the next campaign and the campaign after that, and a few other bits and pieces.
Very cool. I've been doing a lot of real life stuff. I have been completely revamping my painting office / hobby room space, and seeing my entire pile of shame in one pile is scary. It's very scary. And I've been writing a campaign for Necromunda, which I have floated past James, but he's been incredibly busy and probably hasn't read it yet. But hopefully at some point that can be worked in, because I've got a nice little encapsulated idea around maybe revisiting some stuff that we've done in the past. So anyway, well, that up and coming, and you're getting a sneaky peek on that one, Justin. Anyway, should we move on to the reason we're all here? The reason that we've got Justin with us tonight is that we want to do a deep dive on the lore of the primary antagonist of Gildas Ford, Gangrene, that we've mentioned before in various episodes, but we've never actually gone deep into. And we know that the listeners, you guys, love the idea of the lore and what we do in Gildas Ford. So we wanted to get Justin in as the progenitor of Gangrene himself, and the various splinter bits and pieces that we'll get into. But Dixie, I think, as the arbiter of arbiters in the Gildas Ford setting, set the scene for everyone and explain how it fits, and then we'll dive into a bit of a chat with Justin.
Okay, so where to start with Gangrene? We've got to go back quite a long way.
So we've been 10 years.
It is about 10 years. Yeah, I was just recapping through all of my notes earlier this afternoon to remind myself of all the things, all the terrible, terrible things that he's done over the years. So we have to go back to the Great Fire. So this was a widespread fire that ripped through Gildas Ford and destroyed huge amounts of the territory. In the aftermath of the fire, as part of when they were sort of clearing the wreckage and starting the rebuilding efforts, we ran a campaign called The Rebuilding. And the first
Gildas, wasn't it? New Gildas?
Yes, the discovery of New Gildas. So in clearing the wreckage, they basically uncovered this sort of network of tunnels that part of the settlement had collapsed into underneath Gildas Ford. And they sent work crews down and they never came back. So they gathered some of the sort of willing local gangs and sent them down to explore it and find out what was down there. This was a sort of opening game of the campaign. It was a big multiplayer using the Space Hulk tiles and bits and pieces. So it was lots of tunnel exploration, Zone Mortalis stuff, lots of things in the darkness popping out and doing, all sorts of stuff. So in the middle of this, there was this big chamber with lots of loot tokens and lots of stuff inside. And the only person, the only player, the only character of any of the gangs that were in that, and there was probably 8 or 9 players in that campaign, but the only person who actually made it to that central chamber and survived the encounter was Justin's gang leader, Gangrene. Then he blacked out, he woke up on the surface, didn't think much more of it, and that the campaign carried on. Afterwards, nobody could recall exactly where this chamber was or what was in it or anything like that, despite questioning by Precinct 19 and so on and so forth. The decision was made to sort of settle partly into New Gildas, and now we have this kind of two extra parts to the settlement. We've got Old Gildas, which was the original fire-damaged area, and New Gildas, which is this kind of newly uncovered but largely intact dome area underneath the original settlement of Gildas Ford. So Gangrene is kind of in that campaign. He's a gang leader. I'll be interested to know which gang shortly that any of you think he's from, which house, which would be quite an interesting conversation. But he pops up in this campaign anyway, and he's leading this gang. And he doesn't really come to Precinct 19's attentions again until much more towards the end of that campaign. There's another gang called the Spring City Scrappers. And basically what's happening in this is because of the fire, there's a big shortage of food and supplies and stuff like that. And there's all these kind of mysterious worm-like grub creatures popping up all over the place and attacking work crews who were trying to do the rebuilding. And it turns out that somebody, one of the gangs or one or more of the gangs, have been kind of hoarding black market food goods and stashing them around Gilders Ford. And it's determined by Precinct 19 undercover operatives that it's the Spring City Scrappers, or, you know, masterminding this food operation. Word gets out to them that they're going to be raided by Precinct 19. The Precinct 19 undercover operative in that gang manages to reschedule the raid. The PDF, the Necromunda Spiders, turn up, raid the Spring City Scrappers compound. And at the same time, Gangrene's gang also attacks, trying to get his hands on the loot from the Spring City Scrappers, doesn't realise that the raid has been rescheduled, also hits the PDF at the same time. This massive firefight ensues. It's an absolute bloodbath, but Gangrene makes himself, you know, very well known to Precinct 19 at that point. He disappears after that because things get very, very heated. He becomes outlawed in the following campaign, the Consequences campaign. The Consequences was a three-part narrative that a lot of people are still very unhappy with, Ross.
That was fun. The ceiling or something, sorry.
There was a flooding and a ceiling and explosion and... yes, it was. That was, we'll go into that one in more detail because that was a long story arc, but it was good fun. He then pops up again as part of the Consequences campaign. There is the incident, and I have to use air quotes for the incident. The incident is something that is not officially recorded anywhere in the histories of Gilders Ford. There are lots and lots and lots of rumours about what it is and what it was. Lee, you and Justin will remember those games. Ross, I'm not so sure. Lawrence probably isn't aware of them, actually, thinking about it.
Before Lawrence's time.
No, before me.
But I like the idea of the players filtering that information amongst themselves to try and work out exactly what the incident was, because it is officially just referred to as the incident. There is no detailed records about any of it. It's just stories in the bars and stuff like that. However, Gangrene officially on the limited records that there are was defeated by Inquisitor Redburn during the incident, but managed to escape capture. And then he goes completely off the radar and nobody hears from him for sort of three campaigns after that, until he pops up again in our recent Fugitives Drift campaign. And obviously we've gone into the details of that quite a lot. And elements of his cult were seen again in the recent Ashgate campaign that we've just finished. So he's there and he keeps popping up in the background, but he's not just a gang leader now. He's kind of developed into this kind of self-declared prophet of the end times. You know, after the fire, he was saying it was the wrath of the emperor and that people should join him. And, once the new Gilders was discovered, he was encouraging gangs to leave and go into new Gilders or leave the settlement entirely and go beyond the wall into the wastelands, setting up in Fugitive's Drift. He's got this huge kind of cult following now.
There seems to be this theme on Necromunda where prophets pop up all over the place, because, you know, there's the prophet in the new book and there's Gangrene and there's Jad. And it's like, you know, there's a thing about Necromunda and prophets.
There is. I mean, it's a very popular place, I suppose. Yeah.
I guess with so many humans in one place, and desperation, you know, it's quite easy to be led on by anybody who thinks they've got a dream, you know. But I guess my question was, so his house, was he a redemptionist?
He was not a redemptionist, no.
Okay.
So at this point we say, Justin, tell us about Gangrene, without giving too much away, because we have to try. I think I know the answer to the question, and that's not just because I could see Yak Tribe here with Justin. But tell us about, you know, you, Gangrene from your perspective, and the origin and the setup and the creation of said
notorious.
Well, it all started back in those campaigns that Dixie very kindly ran for us, and it was really good fun. And basically, I started him off in the house that has not yet been mentioned.
Yes.
And you looked at the wrong house on my Yak Tribe. That was his brother's house.
Ah, right, the brother.
Yeah. So it carried on, and it was he was I was keeping him going. It was really fun, and he started getting a bit of a character about him, especially with his name, which I took from a comic book, because his second in command was also Martial Law.
That's right.
Which was from the same comic book series.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
And he was the one that caused one hell of a lot of damage in that firefight over the food with the PDF. I think he earned 50-odd XP in one game.
Yeah, he had a never-ending heavy stubber, didn't he? You passed every single ammo roll I've never seen. It was like something stupid. It was like 13 ammo rolls a row or something ridiculous.
We kept making that hot shots joke where he's standing on the pile of empty shells.
Yeah, very much so. It was just such an epically fun but silly game in a way.
Well, that's just Necromunda. That's what Necromunda should be.
So, yeah, and carrying him on with obviously Dixie's input, you know, putting him out, outlawing him and stuff like that, and then sort of like playing out the intrigue leading up to the consequences campaign. That was really good fun because... Yeah. Me and myself and Lee were obviously playing opposite sides on that one.
We were.
And it was our job, through Dixie's expression, to go out and try and turn as many gangs to our flag without them quite knowing what they were getting themselves into.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that.
And that was such good fun because it was such sort of like an intrigue going on with me trying to convert people to come out on the Rad Waste with me and yourself trying to keep them inside.
Nudge, wink, wink. You know, come on, boys. Yeah.
Unfortunately, since then, my
what's it? Influence.
Influence is quite known, and it's not as easy to do anymore.
Oh, you did right with Tim in the Outlands campaign.
Yeah, I know. I was doing quite well.
This is the benefit of new players, of course, is they don't necessarily know who they should or shouldn't trust.
Suckers.
Yeah, and especially because it wasn't Gangrene this time, it was, what's his name? I always forget my new leader's name. It was Clostridium Perfrigens.
Right. Was that a name generated by
him? No, actually, the entirety of my gang has the Latin names for diseases as their names.
Ah, very good.
Keeping the whole thing going on in the background.
Good. So, okay, so if I remember correctly, because you do have a penchant for playing Orlok gangs.
Yeah.
So, was Gangrene, was it Orlok?
No.
No, it wasn't Orlok. Okay, my bad.
No, he wasn't an Orlok.
James, you probably know the answer to this.
Oh, I know the answer, yeah. So, the Gangrene in his original form was actually a leader of a Dalak gang.
I know everyone goes, I was just going to say that, but I was just thinking Dalak. But yeah, okay. But I'm so used to Justin playing Orlocks with his harpoons that he's just kind of like, it must be something with the harpoons.
Well, they kind of switched to heavy bolts.
Yeah. But it actually really, in my head, it really suits Gangrene. I mean, the trouble is, he's grown beyond a playable character, realistically. You know, he's now.
He's
yeah,
a special
I,
character.
I,
he's God.
I don't want to ever see Gangrene on the tabletop.
No, I do believe he had his last appearance on the tabletop around Christmas in Gareth's Christmas game.
Yeah, we had a one-off special game. It was Martial Law, wasn't it?
No, it was Gangrene.
No, it was Gangrene, well, but he was unkillable.
That's
he
right.
was absolutely
yes,
unkillable.
Yes, yes. So, you know, he is occasionally cited, but, you know, but yeah, but Dalak kind of suits him really well because of the whole kind of the subtle influences and things like that. So, you know, whispering of two other players and saying, you know, just come in here, a little bit of misinformation here, spreading some rumors and all that kind of stuff. It's it's exactly right for his play style and his character.
Yeah, and you know, swapping to Orlok and where I brought out the new gang, which most people have worked out is Gangrene's brother now.
Yeah.
That was quite good fun because he's more of a blunt tool than he is like the intrigue side of Gangrene.
Yeah.
So it's more sort of like just in your face, just run and...
But actually, I mean, it fits in because if you read the new book, which is all about the redemption and the, you know, the redemption as prophets, that they've got all kinds of different gangs working together. So you preempted all of this by doing that way back in the day without like any kind of official sanction for doing it. It's like, I'm going to be a Dalak, but I've got some Orlocks involved and I might use some, you know, might dupe some redemption or Cordor into it or whatever. So kudos.
Thank you very much. But in fairness, it was all with Dixie's lead. He did run that those campaigns very, very well, like he always does.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yes. So, we love. I mean, the thing I you know, you kind of think with a name like Gangrene, and I've always thought this that you know, there's some chaos influence or some, you know, dare I say it, Nurgle influence in there, and it's never actually been confirmed that that is or isn't happening. But
it never shall be.
No, exactly, and that's very cool. But you always sit there and kind of go, you know, whether does the name lead you down a particular line of thinking in terms of, oh, is it Nurgle or is it Slaanesh or is it whatever?
I mean, I think it's probably worth pointing out that going back to that original big multiplayer game that we had at the start of the rebuilding campaign, I had it fixed in my head before that campaign what would happen to anyone who got into that central chamber. It is pure coincidence that it happened to be Gangrene. It could have been anyone. It could have been multiple people. But it just happened to be Gangrene who got in there and survived the encounter. Again, I don't want to go into details about what that encounter was because it's part of the mystery. But there was an encounter and there was a follow-up to that encounter. And then having Justin and having Gangrene be the survivor, that is when I took Justin aside and said, this is the situation. This is now your secret task for the duration of this campaign. And that's when he started pulling people across. I never fully envisioned it going beyond that campaign, but it has, you know, like a lot of the stuff that we have in our kind of settlement lore, it's formed its own thing, momentum, life. Its own life. It's taken on, you know, Gangrene has just naturally evolved into the protagonist. In the same way that Precinct 19 they're part antagonist. Sorry. Yes, and well, it depends which side you're on, I suppose.
Well, that's true. It's true that.
But
true that.
Yes, no, fair. In the same way that, you know, Precinct 19 and the Great Guild of Conclave and things like that, they were snippets of lore I put in for a specific purpose that have grown into a life of their own and grown off at a tangent. But what's really good for me from an arbitrator perspective is Justin fully embracing the story arc of the character and carrying it on over multiple campaigns. But also the other players leaning into it. You mentioned Tim in the Fugitive's Drift campaign. I mean, Tim with no knowledge of Gangrene or history of Gangrene or anything else, when he went to Gangrene to beg for resurrection package revealed what that resurrection package was, he went, this is fun, and he just leant straight into it and started deliberately trying to injure other people to spread the zombie plague. I really enjoy that aspect of arbitration and the story arcs and the way that players embrace those story arcs, even if they were done 10 years ago and they're still, you know, they're still echoing down the history now.
Yes, I mean, it's like you earlier this was it earlier today finding those snippets from the Guildersford Gazette and just rereading those, just going, this is hilarious, and you know the heretical cult purged thing that you shared, and it's just so good to reread those.
Yeah, they are quite fun. What was it? The
we should put them out, shouldn't we?
This was my favourite one I came across this afternoon. We used to have a physical newsletter. We haven't for the last few campaigns, but I probably should resurrect it now. The Guildersford Gazette.
Yes.
And it used to have lots of adverts and little snippets of information and stuff in. And it was always...
You could even post, like, we could even post, like, things in there, you know, we wanted to sell to, like, territories or services. And, you know, so we're talking pre-internet here, kids, you know, not quite. But, you know, it's kind of that sort of thing, like our version of a messenger.
Yeah, and it was literally paper. People could trade items in there. Awarded people credits for sending in articles and stuff to help with it, you know, small amount of credits, but some credits for contributing towards it, which for other arbitrators out there is a really good way of getting a newsletter and gaining content for it. You know, 10, 20 credits, something minimal, but it's a token gesture.
The ad that you've got in the chat here, wanted 8 squats and an Escher for an elaborate practical joke, costumes supplied. I completely forgot.
It's good, isn't it? I can't actually remember the context, but there was a very... I think it was probably a conversation that was had at the club during a game, and it sort of found its way into the newsletter. But yes, that was quite fun.
If I remember... if I remember correctly, Colin of Never Go Full Colin fame, yes. I think he managed to gain himself a pet spider through the advertisements in
the Angry Crate Spider.
Yeah. Was it a mystery gift?
It was a,
I don't know,
no,
if it was revealed what was in the crate until after.
Yeah, it was a mystery crate that had noises coming from it and nobody wanted to open it, and it was like 50 credits, and he opened it and it was a little pet spider. This is pre exotic pets in the N17 rules, yes. But he picked it up and yeah. We had it, you know, he had a little pet spider for it. I think he had it with Monster actually, possibly.
I vaguely remember something like that, pet with, yeah, because this was the pre, we didn't really have specific rules for pets, so it just kind of acted like a little mini sort of gang.
Yeah, it was just like it was sort of following the pet rules that came out subsequently, actually. It was a little gang member that had to stay within a certain distance of him and activated with him, etc. But pre the official rules. But yeah, the Angry Crate Spider, that was, again, it was just a little spider, but it was quite good fun. But we had all sorts of stuff in there, and there was also throughout all of them, I mean, you kind of all cottoned on at one point, so it became less fun for me to put stuff in, but I used to sneak hints about the campaign outcomes into the newsletters all the time. I think I had one newsletter where an entire paragraph, like a whole paragraph of news, was written out of style of the normal kind of writing. And the first letter, this is in Ross, you're probably going to kill me for this one, because you may not even be aware of this now, but the first letter of each line of that page spelt out, "It's a trap." It was like a whole article telling everyone to go to Crate Island and to investigate these tunnels to find the Spider Queen and all this kind of stuff. And that's the tunnel that then was detonated and collapsed and killed everyone. Yeah. But it was
what's particularly upsetting.
It was there, but what's particularly in plain writing is, for everyone to see that it was a trap. So,
what's upsetting is in real life, as of literally today, I've been teaching my students acrostic poems, which of course are formed by the first letter, you know, a word, and then creating lines from the letter of, you know, each letter in that word. And if I had been teaching that just a few years earlier, I might have spotted your acrostic warning that bit quicker.
Good times.
So Justin, so what's, I mean, without giving too much away, what's the plan going forward?
The plan going forward now is I really want to concentrate on his brother for a bit.
Yeah.
But I also want to try and flesh out with James some of the story arc for one of my old characters, Tenia Solium, which was the wrecker that disappeared into the hive after the Ashway. Yes. Not the Ashways, the Ash Gates campaign.
Yeah, the Future
just
Drift
to try and figure
well.
Out. That's it, Future Drift one.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to figure out what's going on with that, because we've got that lovely, kind of zombified wrecker running around in Guild.
Well, maybe he could run into Sky, whose sole purpose is to hunt said zombies.
Yes, could do that. And equally, we've got the Stormcaller from my Nomads gang that got infected but didn't actually succumb to the zombie plague. And so there could be a little something happening there.
Because as I remember it, Lawrence has got something against that lovely little wrecker.
Yes, I do. Absolutely, I do.
Would you like to elaborate, Lawrence?
Oh, my God, it would not die. Yeah, it had my entire gang shooting at it and throwing combat at it for 6 consecutive turns, I think. You know, it survived dying 3 times to a Death Maiden.
For everyone, this was the finale of the Fugitive Drift campaign, where the few surviving infected gangers that had been gifted resurrection packages by gangrene basically went full zombie mode and could only be killed with an immediate 66 roll. Anything else just didn't count. So there was only 2 of them, but they caused absolute mayhem.
Yeah, I had at least 4 50-something rolls, but no 66.
Yeah. I mean, the 50-something rolls were applying the effects, so they were taking, you know, -1 weapon skill, -1 strength, whatever it was, but they were still standing and fighting after taking that injury.
Yeah, because that was also where Gangrene's brother was the other one. And because he got Gareth tried to run him over with his
That's right, he did.
And then got in a fight with him, and I think he managed to kill one of his own enforcers at that point.
Well, didn't he throw some ridiculous grenade that bounced and came straight back at him and blew up in his face?
He threw I think it was a frag grenade or something. Or a blasting charge. It might have been a blasting charge, but he...
I thought it was something nasty.
It might have been a blasting charge or a demo charge. But yeah, he literally threw it into a whole group of your fighters, Justin, and it scattered back and basically landed at the guy's feet and took out half of his own squad. It was very funny.
Yeah.
But the commander seemed not...
But not the guy who threw it. Yeah, he was absolutely fine.
Yeah. Should we start calling that one friendly fire? No.
But yeah, I mean, Gangrene's still got, you know, he's got a very, he's not going anywhere. He's, you know, he's his base of operations in Fugitive Drift, as we know, has been compromised, and recaptured, but he himself escaped into the Ash Wastes, we assume. Precinct 19 still don't know where he is, or what he's doing, and his flock, you know, his cult following, in Fugitive Drift, Gildas Ford and beyond are very much, you know, an active part of Gildas Ford now. It's
all of a sudden I've got the A-Team theme tune in my head. You know, he's out there in the LA underground, and if you have any problem, if you can find him, whether he can help you, maybe you can hire Gangrene.
I think
just to echo something that Gareth said in previous episodes, and I suspect he'd say in this instance, what's really nice about having like localized antagonists and having this kind of this history. I know Gareth has said it's what lured him into to the club and to successive campaigns. But it also, it personalizes it to us and campaign after campaign, but it also is a bit of a counter to some of the maybe criticisms we've seen about recent books, where now we've got Lady Credo and Lady Helmar herself running round and available as playable characters, which I know some people have claimed, and understandably, it's a bit jarring. It's the scale's almost exploded too high that we have the planetary governess effectively running round in the Underhive, getting into fistfights.
So it's really nice, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's really nice to have that localized villain, whether or not he ever makes the table, as you've said, James. But it just makes it personal. It's our corner of the Underhive. And long may it stay that way.
Yeah, because I think if anyone from Gildas Ford was to travel to a neighbouring dome, I don't know, let's say, just at random, let's say Sump City, they wouldn't know who Gangrene is. They'll be like, who?
No
idea what you're talking about. But obviously everyone in Gildas Ford knows who he is, and I like that. That's, you know, that locality and that kind of... He's big in Precinct 19's eyes because he's a very prominent local threat, but on the grand scale of things in Necromunda, he's absolutely nothing.
He's a local villain for local people.
I mean, another option that we've always got, and again, you know, you've alluded to that occasionally we've done it on the odd kind of occasion game, is introduce him as a, you know, as a playable character, but probably as a bounty hunter or someone like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what is also nice from my point of view is that I had this character that I put a lot of time in, played him, got him through scrapes and that. He lost an arm and all sorts of things went on. But it's now not my character anymore. It's actually Gildas Ford's character.
It's evolved.
Yeah, so that has been the most interesting part for me, to actually see that kind of thing grow, see where Dixie's taken it and how everybody else has embraced it. That is what's made this whole thing very special for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome. Ross?
Hello?
Sorry, you had your hand up. I wanted to say something, and obviously that was from earlier, and you didn't take it down, so fine, whatever. No, I mean, I could consider
myself rebuked, apologies.
Slap. No, I think it's phenomenal, and the way that the each of these individual things evolved, a little bit like Rich and the him setting up these bases all the time, Dixie. I mean, that's almost kind of, you know, morphing into something that's owned by Gildas Ford rather than Rich. With the group has a bad habit of doing stuff like that.
Well, they do. I mean, but that in itself, I mean, the reason that Rich did that in the Ashgate campaign was because he'd done that in the previous campaign.
Exactly,
yeah. The Osiris. Yeah, so the Oasis base that was set up in Fugitive Drift. So, you know, I like, again, people, it's the whole, you guys create these story arcs. I put a framework in place. I come up with a broad narrative of what I want to happen in a campaign. But even in the Ashgate campaign, like, I didn't anticipate that Rich would come to me and say, I've got this isotopic fuel rod and I want to set up a settlement, because I set up the Oasis settlement and it's the same, you know, it's a splinter of that gang. And I want to carry that legacy on because they want to expand out and set up this base of operations. I didn't expect him to do that, but it's really nice that he did.
No, it's fantastic. Well, I think we could talk all night on this topic, but I think it's really nice encapsulated introduction to gangrene, and I'm sure we'll revisit it. But Justin, thank you very much for coming down and talking about your insane creation, and long may gangrene stick around forever.
Well, he is the one true prophet of Guild.
Some would say.
That's what he likes to
I think if, yeah. If any of the listeners have got any kind of specific questions about gangrene or his story, or have had similar, you know, story arcs in their own campaigns along those lines, I think it'd be really interesting to hear that.
Yes.
I've got one, Dixie, actually. So if you were to put a wanted poster up for Gangrene, what distinguishing characteristics are we likely to see? Describe Gangrene to us.
Right, now you'll like this. So I was playing around on ChatGPT earlier, and not Mid Journey yet, but I was playing on ChatGPT first, and I fed all of the information from about Gangrene from the Book of Guildersford that I'm working on into ChatGPT, and then I said, tell me what Gangrene would look like. Basically.
Interesting.
It was quite interesting, because it basically described him as being where is it? I'm just trying to find it. Sorry, bear with me a second. It basically described him as being kind of a tall, imposing figure with a bald head and one arm. Which really reflects it, and there's nothing in there about him being Dalak, but that's the first type of look that springs to mind.
All I'm going to say is all that's ever been seen of him is a green metallic mask.
Right,
green metallic mask. What is he?
That is true. Yeah. So I think again, I don't. Wanted posters are a tricky one. And in the same way that making him a playable character on the tabletop, I don't think we necessarily want anyone to know what he looks like exactly.
Yeah.
And there may be many reasons for that. That's all I'm going to say.
Exactly. Being Dalak, is it a bit like he's Alpharius, that everyone thinks he's their gangrene, but he's not really?
It's just the one gangrene, actually.
Honest gov. Anyway, and at that point, I think there's perfect juncture to segue into our next segment, because interestingly, this beautifully does, because we're going to talk about the stack of whack. And Ross, we've had a rather filthy submission about the Dalak that I've christened the Dalak stack. So on with it.
Absolutely. The Dalak stack of whack. And this one has come winging its way from the other hemisphere of the planet, and Aaron Visser's in Victoria, Australia. Because we don't like to brag, listeners, but we are big in Australia. And Aaron's build is centered on the already slightly horrific Nakhtgul, the specialist champion that the Dalak can run, particularly with its serpent's fangs, which are these Wolverine-style claws, as far as the model's concerned, that have paired and phased and rending and this and that and the other. Long story short, being the Serpent's Fangs, give you 2+2 strength, no save, and on a 6 on your wound roll, if I remember correctly, you get a +1 damage. So it's pretty nasty, the Nakhtgul. But that wasn't good enough for Aaron. Aaron wanted more. So he has come up with a horrendous combination. He's making use of the classic Dalak move of using either one of the psychoteric worms or a thrall alongside a phantom with perinumbral mirror. Excuse me, guys, consult my notes there. And Perinumbral Miracles allows the Phantom to, via a thrall or a psychoteric worm, effectively catapult the Nactgull from one position to another, as long as he is away 5 inches within range of the thrall or the worm, and you can catapult him 5 inches away from an enemy fighter. So you've got an opportunity to fling this character effectively behind his opponent and get him into close combat. But that's fairly standard for the Dalak since House of Shadows came out. It's what he's loaded the Nactgull up with. So the Nactgull has a base, somewhat underwhelmingly perhaps, of 2 attacks. However.
I sense the however.
Aaron's given him a full servo harness, giving +2 strength, giving +1 toughness. He's giving him a Friends on Collar to give him a Berserker skill with +1 charge, and Nerves of Steel, and True Grit, and Unstoppable. And while my maths is questionable at the best of times, that, I believe, based on my calculations, Aaron's notes, takes your Nactgull all of a sudden up to strength 8. It also puts his toughness all the way up to, I believe, toughness 4. So you are effectively running and striking with 2 attacks, doubled on the charge because of one
the
moment.
Paired weapons.
Thank you, James. You can tell I prepared well. My notes are failing me at the last minute. 2 attacks, doubled up to 4 attacks because of paired. Thank you, James. +1 for having a second melee weapon. So that takes us up to 5 attacks. Berserker then would take us up to 6 attacks. And then finally, I believe, 7 attacks because of the charge.
Doesn't Friends on, is that just toughness and strength?
So Friends on, the Berserker gives you +1 on the charge on top of any other attack modifiers. Nerves of Steel obviously gives you that roll to avoid pinning. And True Grit and Unstoppable play into your effectively survivability. So even if he didn't make a dent with this, what were we up to just then? 7 attacks, potentially at strength 8. And of course, because of the Serpent's Fangs phase condition, there are no armor saves functionally. No armor saves and no field armor saves, although invulnerable saves are still observed. Is that enough?
I can make it worse.
Yeah, well, I think we'll make it worse. Should we add some Stim Slug Stash on top of that?
No, I wasn't going there, but yes.
Because that will then take you up to a total, last time I checked, of strength 10, toughness 6, and a move of 8.
Well, if you stacked on top of that the 30-point upgrade, Psychoteric Whispers, to make him an unsanctioned psyker, you could give him Cacophony of Silence, and everyone who attacks it would have to re-roll successful hit rolls for attacks. Range attacks.
Absolutely disgusting. So, thank you very much to Aaron for sending that in. What Aaron did say
Ross, just rather than Cacophony of Silence, you could do Eternal Slumber. It's all seriously injured enemies within 3 inches go out of action. So you don't even have to, even if he's multiply engaged, he doesn't even have to coup de grace because he just goes, psychic action, you're all seriously injured, you're all dead.
Yeah, the one thing Aaron did say is we've talked in previous episodes about the perceived invulnerability of the Cargo 8 Ridge Hauler. He reckons he could have it.
That I would like to see.
That's a big claim.
I'd like to see that.
I think we need we need him to try that and send us the evidence.
Yeah, and we would
pictures, please.
I think I worked out that it needs something like 17 dice on average, even at a high strength, to do that.
Yeah, let's not forget.
Unless you're Jacob, and then you just need a very good plasma shot.
Well, I was about to say Jacob being the arbiter of all destruction.
He rolled it.
He said
destroyed it, not rolled it.
Rolled it. Rolled it's fine.
Let's not forget, though, that with that, if my maths was correct, those 7 attacks that the Nactical's throwing out, he is hitting on a 2+ as his base weapon skill. So the odds, apart from my ability to roll, the odds are generally in your favour in that.
I mean, to be fair, against a Ridge Hauler in combat, +1 to hit, double location dice, and phase, presumably, I haven't checked the wording of it, but if it works exactly the same against vehicles and doesn't allow an armor save, etc., It is potentially a very good way of taking down a Ritualer.
Oh, I've just pulled Faze up just now. It says save rolls granted by armor or field armor cannot be made against a weapon with this trait. If the target is hit, treat them as having no save. However, saves granted by special rule. So there's no mention of fighters or models specifically. It's simply if a model, if we use that, has an armor save. Well, no, it doesn't anymore.
Yeah, I think the vehicle one is described as armor, so I think that's fair enough.
It is armor, so it would apply.
Yeah, I have to admit that the durability of vehicles comes down to those damage tables.
True.
And obviously the cargo weight having so many hull points. But, you know, might be able to do it. Let's see it.
The other thing I've suggested, which we will do at some point, is once we have enough stack of whack entries, we will hold a stack of whack off.
Deathmatch.
Because that would be hilarious fun.
Deathmatch. Nobody can catch the mate.
Yes.
Let's get it on.
She just never ends combat.
She's too busy zipping around the outside.
She's gone.
But yeah, a massive thank you out to Aaron for getting in touch with his disgusting Delac stack of whack hashtag. And as you've just touched on, James, we would love any and all submissions, but please do ask parental and arbitrator permission before dropping any of these heinous crimes on the tabletop.
Yes, absolutely. Right. I mean, was that it for the stack this time? Do we have anything else? Because I know we've had some submissions and we are kind of curating them carefully. But were we talking about anything else, or was that?
We do very carefully check they are legal.
Yeah. Legal. We use that term loosely.
Legal, perhaps not intended.
None of this is intended. Wow. Okay.
So, if anyone, just as a side thought, stack of whack aside, you know, it is quite good fun to put these things together as a largely, I hope, as a proof of concept. But if anyone has actually played these or faced them on the tabletop, we'd like to hear from you as well, because how you might deal with them. Because we know how we might deal with various things, but it's always interesting to see what other people come up with.
It's crime mostly, isn't it?
It involves your bell.
A lot of the time it involves my bell, yeah. Yeah. But there's only one of me, and I'm quite a long way from Australia, so the generally very good at dealing with painful, exotic creatures that sting quite a lot, but I'd be interested to see how they deal with a rogue Nakgul.
Yes. Well, speaking of using Dixie's bell, the perfect segue into the next topic, which is going to be an interesting one to discuss, because we, leading on from the stack of whack itself into how using them, you know, potentially dare they be used, or other maybe not quite so in your face combinations, how do dealing with players, different players with different objectives in a campaign work? So for example, how do you cope with some players who are very competitive, whack, versus some players who are doggedly narrative? And in the same campaign, you know, from a playing perspective, as one of those two playing against someone who is the exact opposite, and also Dixie, how do you arbitrate that? Because that's got to be difficult.
It is very difficult. I think it's important to find the right players for starters, and I think we've been very lucky because the club, generally speaking, attracts the right type of player for Necromunda.
Or Felix, our kind of Necromunda.
And I think that is a very important thing to put into context, is that the club that you're in, to a degree, will shape the way you play. Because when you start playing, you know, particularly when you've got a lot of players, I mean, if we had every single Necromunda player at the club involved in a campaign, we'd have maybe 30 people, which is, you know, a significant amount. There are a lot of different play styles within that, but generally it's sort of self-regulating to a degree. And I'll come back to that in a bit. But it is very difficult to balance. But I think the players do have a big part in balancing things themselves, as well as from an arbitration perspective. But the bell helps, like the threat of being hit with a bell if you're that guy, will work wonders.
Yeah. I mean, I think fairly early on, especially, I mean, you know, we always give Colin a bit of a hard time, you know, never go full Colin and all that. We still need those bumper stickers. You know, when Colin pulled Monster, and I think all of us, the penny dropped and we went, oh, wow. Like, we hadn't even seen, like, even contemplated the notion of putting that kind of thing together. And then how do you even deal with... I mean, do you remember that game where he put Monster out there, and I think I brought four named bounty hunters, including Cal Jericho, and Monster just sort of laughed and killed them all without really shrugging. You know, I think it was Mad Donna, Cal Jericho, and then I think Gore Halfhorn and one of the other ones, and it just, like, it was nothing.
Yeah,
just gone. And how, and, you know, against named characters, you how are you coping? Let alone, you know, if I was playing or whoever was playing in a super narrative kind of super fluffy way, you can imagine. You know, pests at home going up against that, it would just be
but terrible. Also, leaping to Colin's defense, I guess there was an element that, like, Colin, along with the rest of us, we were all entering into a brand new version of the game, a brand new edition, weren't we?
Yeah.
So we were very much, all of us, testing the limits of the rules as written. So as much as we tongue in cheek, we love and we will continue to use hashtag go never go full Colin. He never did it in an oppressive or
I think that, way that's did a he. Very important point, Ross. I think because yes, he came up with the character, and yes, it was horrific, and yes, we all sort of were like, how do we deal with this? But the way he played Monster, that particular game, Lee, with the bounty hunters, we'll come back to in a second, but in the actual campaign, the way he played Monster, he never played it too whack. Like, it was a character in his gang. He repeatedly told, like, laughed about how low intelligence he had and all this kind of stuff. And in fact, I was reading one of the newsletter, the Gazette articles earlier, where do you remember his gang leader was killed? He bled out at the doctor's table towards the end of the campaign. Somebody went toe to toe with the leader and Monster and managed to take out the leader and cause a critical injury. And the leader then bled out of the dock because Colin didn't have enough money to pay for the doctor. And in the Gazette, Monster just smashed the doctor's surgery to pieces in anger and killed the doctor because he hadn't saved the gang leader. So it's like, you know, he played him narratively, even though it was a whack character. But the bounty hunter game was a specific thing that we put together because we said, look, this is the character. How could we defeat him? Let's try putting the best ones that were available at the time, the best sort of characters that were there, and pit it against it. And again, he just sort of stood there. He didn't actively go after them. He just stood, if I remember, he stood in a corner. Well, everyone went to him and he just battered them back again.
Exactly, he didn't need, because, you know, I think in a very kind of, for me, very cocky sense, oh, I've got Cal Jericho, I've got Mad Donna, you know, this should be, you know, this should be easy. And I remember Mad Donna walking up and he literally just went SWAT, like, just like she was gone within like one round of combat, and that's the point when I was like, oh, okay, this could be a little bit, you know, like, but yeah, I do remember that thinking. I was far too overconfident, and not even then, having played against Monster in the campaign and being at the end of, you know, a massive charge and being absolutely crushed by the attacks, not fully realizing the toughness and the longevity of that particular character. And just to kind of finish the point, you know, having shown Andy Hoare it directly, you know, the combinations and the cards and the things that he stacked, you know, the look on Andy Hoare's face, the like, what the hell is this kind of thing, you know, just demonstrated the genius, you know, let's be honest, the utter genius of the combination that Colin came up with. But it's the, I think you're right in the how it's applied as opposed to exactly what was come up with.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, what he was doing actually still fairly fits in the fluff scale of things. You know, actually, in our club, it's quite common for gangs to have something quite nasty in there. You know, I saw Richard with his, you know, psychic power, so suddenly heals up people completely, and suddenly that can change missions.
Well, I think
Justin was talking about heavy bolters or something was going on in his gang. Admittedly, maybe not on that scale,
I wouldn't say. I was going to say. I'm just going to interject and say I wouldn't say that the psychic power that heals people is overpowered. I think it's situational.
When used in some combinations, it can be incredibly powerful. But either way, I think the point was that none of this stuff is so broken that, you know. In fact, you know, Ross, I think you before have actually used a hyper or a maybe watered down hyper maiden on the table once.
He did against me.
Yeah. But, you know, interesting what kind of prompted this conversation was actually listening to another group talking about how their arbitrator basically had to micromanage the entire group, perhaps because of maybe an inability to trust them on some of the admin-y stuff, perhaps. I mean, James, what's your opinion on some of that?
Well, again, it's difficult, really, because I think it depends on the nature of your players. So, ultimately, if you don't trust your players to do their own admin, rolling income after the game or rolling experience, things like, you know, whatever it might be, if they decide to fluff that and increase it, or, you know, say they got 100 credits when they only got 50 or whatever it might, you know, whatever tweak they decide to make, they're only really punishing themselves because there's no enjoyment to that. Ultimately, you're going to, you know, let's say you do that in game 2, you give yourself an extra 50 credits because you really want a particular piece of war gear, say. You then will use that war gear for the rest of the campaign, knowing that you are not entitled to it, and there, you know, you won't enjoy the campaign as much as a result. And if you win the campaign as a result of buying that war gear, then you haven't really won the campaign. Do you know what I mean? It's
certainly true. I mean, what I think is perhaps there might be a bit of a fine line between deliberately and, some of these rules you've really got to read quite carefully. For example, I think it was before I was at this club, actually, I had made the mistake of giving Goliath Gangers 2 Genesmith upgrades. Just hadn't read the rules well enough and hadn't realised that actually that wasn't allowed. But I'd spent the whole campaign doing it before someone pointed out that wasn't possible. And I thought, oh no, but it wasn't done on purpose. I think there definitely needs to be a degree of... kind of just let it roll, I think. And it was interesting to hear that this other group really, really came down hard on that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I think it depends what it is. Again, like there are a lot of rules. We've got, 15 books now. There is a lot of stuff there. You know, that's reasonable that something is going to be messed up at some point and people are going to make mistakes. They're going to forget to roll something. We had it in the Ashgate campaign. We had it a few times where people said, you know, we finish the evening. Generally, people will roll with their opponent watching for income or for upgrades or trading or capture rolls, whatever it might be. The few occasions that people forgot to roll something specific, they just dropped me a message afterwards and said, can you roll X for me? And I would just, you know, I'd grab a couple of D6 and I'd roll it for them, whatever it was. So I think that works generally quite well. And I'm not sort of sitting there going, has this person messaged me to roll them some dice because they have rolled badly themselves and they want me to roll it for them so they don't feel so bad. I'm like, no, they genuinely have forgotten because, you know, I've known this person for a long time and I trust them and they're not the type of person who would do that, generally speaking. So, yeah. So I think, I also don't think if you've got 14 players, frankly, nobody's got the time to micromanage 14 players on a weekly basis. Unless you're literally not doing anything else. Yeah. You know, I've got a full-time job and a child and a wife and everything else. So it's, you know, I don't have the capacity to do that. And I'm not interested in micromanaging to that degree.
It's funny you mention about people getting in touch and asking you to roll, James, because it never really occurred to me. That's why, whether you wanted them or not, down the years, I've sent you multiple videos of me throwing dice on the carpet at home, haven't I? I quite often get my partner to roll them, and she doesn't seem to be any better at it than I am.
It's always entertaining to receive, though, Ross. So quite happy for you to carry on doing that.
Yeah, they usually end with a swear word, don't they, before the video cuts out.
Yeah, or your partner saying, "Why the hell are you making me do this?"
I often have the opposite problem, you know, if I've forgotten to get something done at the club and I roll the dice and go, oh no, you know, all of these are fours and up. Oh yeah, there's you know, I've just rolled my slopper and I pulled somebody out of recovery. No one's going to believe me.
I often
sort of go, you know, if I've forgotten to roll the dice, I'll just count it as a failure.
Yeah. I've done that a couple of times with rare trade. Like, go to the thing, oh, I've forgotten to roll it. And a couple of times I've rolled two sixes and just gone, oh, no, just that didn't
happen. Oh, look, I've got a caryatid.
Exactly. It's like, oh, no. It's just like, I mean, we did have one instance, actually, legitimately. It was Darren, wasn't it, James, that you rolled on four caryatids on the bounce or something like that. And then we realised, oh, you can only have
one. Yeah, that was a bit weird, actually. He was definitely destined for something. I think he died, though, didn't he, in the end, that guy? I think the gang leader died. Yeah.
Did the caryatids eat him?
Carried him away to some higher place.
Yeah. All four of them flew him off at the same time like cherubs.
They were like the two fairies in different directions in the Hellboy film.
No, yeah, I mean, I think for me, I think it really comes down to the application of things, because sometimes you, Ross, when I'm in the Drift campaign where, you know, I go up against the Death Maiden, you sort of sit on the end of it and going, oh God, here it comes. But you know that it's come from a place of love, right? Rather than someone sitting there going, I am going to pummel whoever it is into the ground because, you know, I want to do that. And I'm sure, I mean, I would, if I was coming up with, and I haven't deliberately tried to come up with my own stack of whack, but I know that there would be part of me that would sit there and just go, this is going to be funny. And you know, that kind of evil streak, which I think is part of the reason why I haven't done it.
I mean, with my early iteration of the Hyper Maiden that obviously Adam Smith in over at Watford honed to a razor's edge. I think I was. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I think I was already vaguely apologetic before I dropped it on you, wasn't I? I think
you did. You said I'm really sorry about this, but, and I thought, oh, here it comes.
I really wanted to see if it would land.
I think the difference is, though, Ross, that you didn't go into that game thinking, This is what I'm going to hinge my game around. It was just that you happened to get that combination of things available to you and went, do you know what? Let's just do it. See what happens. And then you didn't do it again because you never got that combination again.
No, that's very true. Because I think it was, as we've talked in previous episodes, the Dixie's tactics card approach does stimmy these overpowered stack of whack combos that we like to sort of dally around.
That is very true. And I think that is actually one of the things that stops an awful lot of it happening, because you might sit there and go, oh, I'm going to do X, Y, Z, P and Q. I mean, guilty as charged in regards to 40K, because what am I doing at the moment? I'm about to start playing 40K 10th edition because I got talked into it. And what am I doing at the moment? I am on Warhammer Competitive. I am in whatever, looking at lists going, what is the most, you know, killer list going? Because I'm doing it in 40K. I'm not doing it in Necromunda, right? And I think, but because you have the freedom in those game systems to pick whatever you want, you can build those lists because you're not being either affected in some sort of narrative sense, but equally you haven't got an arbiter going, you can't take that because you're randomly generating either powers or units or whatever. And so all of these stacks or all of these things that we're building and we're putting out to the community, if they follow Dixie's tactics cards, you should patent this, Dixie. This is yours. They're like Hive guys. You know, that they can't do it. You can't do it because you can't go, well, I'll take this and this and this and this and this, and this produces this amazing Uber, whatever it happens to be.
No, you're likely to get part of it at some point. Yeah. I mean, particularly if you're using house skills or house tactics, for example. But you know, again, like with the Nactical one, like you'd have to be very long into the campaign to get that amount of skill combinations and bits and pieces together to pull that off. And if you manage to pull it off once towards the end of the campaign as a one-off, as a, look, I've put this together, I've spent the whole campaign working towards it, I'm going to use it once against you. Great. I don't really have a problem with that. What I do have a problem with is somebody coming in game two, building it and then spending the rest of the campaign hinging every single game around that combination, because all that's going to do is make people not want to play them.
You touched on something important as well. I must admit, sit down and cost that Nactical stack of whack build, but full server harnesses, aren't going to come in cheap.
It's going to be 600-700 credits off the top of my head, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, so the rest of the gang are armed. They're not even with fighting knives. They've got slightly blunt butter knives, because that's all the rest of the gang can afford, potentially, if you've got a campaign with a low income. Mm.
Bearing in mind, you have to also have the combination of the other gangers and the worm and the other stuff.
160 credits, rare 12, full server harness.
Yeah, and that's before the Nat Gull itself with the serpent's fangs as well. Yeah. And the potential stim slug stash and.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, that's a whole gang's worth of stacking to get to that thing. But again, you know, Sackawack isn't necessarily around actively using these creatures or these gangers in a campaign. It's theory crafting, isn't it, really?
Yes. I mean, that's kind of where it started from. Because, I mean, obviously it started from it being, you know, what Colin, we love you, started, and then obviously going, well, let's spinal tap this thing and turn it up to 20, because obviously, you know, that isn't the end all and be all of things, and you know, there are other things that are available, you know, the Hyper Maiden, the Nactical, all the other bits and pieces that we've received. But I suppose it's that thing around, you know, how do people, and again, going out to the community, because obviously, you know, we've had some, you know, interactions with people about the different ways that Arbiters are dealing with this, either from a heavy micromanagement perspective or not. How is it happening with you? What happens when you get that guy or that girl or that person in your club that you know is gonna produce the whatever it is that's gonna absolutely table you? I mean, how do you guys deal with it? Because, you know, I mean, for me, I just, you know, it's one of those, well, it's kind of inevitable. It's sort of just, you flinch, it's going to hurt, but there we go. You just sort of take it and get on with it, right?
I do wonder whether the generic GW written rules, whether they don't lead us, even though it's obviously advertised as a narrative game first and foremost, and that's, you know, that's the primary driver for all of us here, but whether they don't lead us down the garden path a little bit, because some of the stats, we know our gangs need a bit of specialism. But I know the previous edition, you started with a generic stat line, did you not, Dixie?
Well, you did, and there's definitely a degree of the houses have clear specialisms now, and if you're playing that house, and let's isolate the house gangs here specifically, but you know, if you're playing Vansar, you're going to go generally, you know, firepower heavy, because you're going to make the use of your ballistic skill and your access to good weapons. If you're playing Goliath, you're going to go for upfront and personal, generally speaking. If you're playing Orlok, you're probably going to go, you know, heavy bolter and whatnot, and so on and so forth. So there are those degrees of specialism. There are access to the equipment that kind of flavors that gang to a degree. But there is a line between leaning into it because that's what your house is from a narrative perspective to min-maxing it to get the absolute most out of that particular gang. Looking back at the Ashgate stuff, and it's very interesting thinking at which players played narratively versus which players didn't play so narratively, and looking at who won and who lost and where they sort of finished in the hierarchy of the campaign is quite interesting.
I mean, one thing I would say is actually, more often than not, the mission isn't necessarily one on your build. It can often be one on how you play a game. It doesn't necessarily...
That's true.
And a decent mission, actually, can, you know, in particular, those ones that say, you know, you've got a couple of fighters from the attacker, or the defender and the attacker gets their whole gang. Typically, the attacker will be the lower rated gang, and the guy who's probably min maxed is, I suspect, doing higher rating, and therefore only bringing to bear a subset of his gang anyway.
I think
those missions are quite good field levelers.
They can be, but the problem is, especially with, and to use Ross's Hyper Maiden or mini Hyper Maiden as an example. The problem with, I mean, that was a looter's style game, wasn't it, Ross? We had to get crates, or we had to get something in the middle. And the second you inject that level of danger into a part of the board that you probably not going to say shouldn't be, but likely wouldn't have been unless you've kind of buffed the thing to make it happen. It's almost important in that particular game for me. You know, the Hyper Maiden shows up in my deployment zone in turn two, puts three or four people either seriously injured or out of action because of the AoE effect that it has, and that, you know, all the rest of it. And at that point, you literally, the entire game plan vanishes, because all you're doing then is it becomes the ultimate distraction Carnifex.
But how many games have been lost by going too aggressive? You know, because what can happen is you can go so aggressive, you force your enemy to bottle, the game's over, but you've not secured the objective.
Well, that's fair.
I mean, quite a lot of the missions don't then retrospectively give it to you just because you tabled your opponent.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair enough. I mean, as I say, I think going back to Ross's point about the rules and all the rest of it, and I have my own particular take on the way that I don't think the rules are particularly... balance is the wrong word. I mean, you know, Necromunda is not a game for balance, but I don't think the rules are particularly thought out in terms of the equivalence of things. You know, so if you take something like a Goliath Zerko, that, you know, kind of a monster type build, and you go, okay, great, that does its thing, what I want to see is kind of where's the equivalent of that, you know, in other gangs, so that, you know, you can put something down, you know, a little bit like in the Ashgate campaign. You know, we talk about the Mauler, which, you know, is an incredible vehicle, and you look at the other gangs and go, where's everyone else's version of that? Thanks. And it doesn't exist. And I think this is my beef, I think, with the way that a lot of... It's not just a Necromunda phenomenon. You know, look at the... Again, go back to the 40K stuff. You look at the indexes that have just come out for 40K. They are so all over the place that, you know, you think if you're going to reset everything back to the beginning of a new, completely new version of the game, and you're going to put everyone out there, ideally, or at least this is my take on it, everyone should be starting on basically the same even keel. You know, everyone's about the same plus or minus a little bit.
But I think Games Workshop threw away that philosophy a long time ago.
Well, exactly, because they're trying to sell models, right? Or they're trying to push people in a certain direction.
I think they're also trying to differentiate themselves in the market as well. There are a few games out there where, you know, the factions are basically identical. It's just different.
Yeah, players,
and at one point, you know, games, in particular 40K, was very much like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree actually with that, because in terms of not, you know, letting everyone be the same. Again, going back to what we were saying earlier on, where Ross said, you know, original Necromunda, every gang was essentially, barring the Outlander gangs, was essentially a copy paste job with different lists, you know, to weapons and skills and things. So everyone kind of did start the same, and it was very easy to play a Vansar gang as a combat gang, or an Orlok gang as a firing gang, or whatever combination you wanted. There are distinct house differences. It's always been the case in the new version of Necromunda that Goliath for the combat gang, you know, Escher of the fast gang, yeah, Vansar of the sneaky, yeah, gang, firing gang, sorry, and Dalak of the sneaky gang, and that kind of stuff. So I don't have a problem with Goliath having a Mauler and nobody else having an equivalent, because if you want to use a Mauler, play Goliath. If you want to use poison weapons, play Escher. If you want to punch people in the face, yeah, at point, you know, close range with an axe, use Goliath. Those are there to help the flavors of those gangs and to pick them. There are combinations to, generally speaking, to fight against each of those particular elements.
Yeah, I totally see where you're coming from. I think the thing I loved about, and maybe this is, you know, rose tinted spectacles and all the rest of it, I think I loved about the old rules, where everyone started off, relatively speaking, if everyone was starting from a new gang, because that's one of the things I also loved about the old system, where you could bring old gangs into new campaigns, right? And there was a retirement, but anyway, that's a side point, where I felt like you get a lot more control over how the gang evolves and how you craft the gang into exactly what you want it to be. Whereas I do, to some degree, with the new system, feel like if, for argument's sake, you said, well, I want to play a Goliath game, but I want to make them a shooty gang, it's really, really hard. You're kind of on rails. You kind of can't do that. And I something about that grates with me, because that limits my narrative choices and go, you know, I don't want to play a crushy, you know, dumb, you know, kind of Goliath gang. I want to play a shooty Goliath gang. They'll be rubbish at it, but I want to do it because, and it kind of, it then, but by doing that, you sort of accept the fact that you're probably not going to win anything and you just have to kind of take that hit.
Or as the player who occasionally does this, and to be fair, you know, I probably am more the min-max end of the spectrum. You look at what's available to you and you look at, well, how do you make it viable? And I'd say Goliath is a great example, because they've got the gene smithing, you know, and I'll be the first to put my hand up and own up and say, you know what, on the Goliath I give a gun to, I intentionally lower their strength because it cheapens them out again, so that I can afford to put something more tasty on a combat fighter.
Yeah.
You know, that's exactly min-maxing. It's taking what I want to do with the gang and say, cool, okay, well, how do I mitigate their, how do I increase their strengths and mitigate their weaknesses? And all of the gangs let you do it to a degree. You know, on an Escher, you know, why would you buy the Morto guns? They cost 20 credits when a LAS gun is 5. You know, that's min-maxing, yeah, ultimately. You know, looking at the costs of those chems and going, okay, well, which one is going to get me the best bang for my buck, you know, when it comes to the trading post? It's min-maxing. Is it wrong? Not necessarily. I think it all comes down to how it's applied, really.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the Mauler example, the Mauler is a very good vehicle, as Lee said. We've seen that in the campaign with your ones, Lawrence, running two of those in the gang.
Yeah.
So, eventually. But
yeah,
if you were to play another Ash Waste campaign, for example, you know, would or other people now having faced those Maulers, would they look at it and go, well, it's 100 credits, so I'll take 4 of them, for example? And then, you know, yeah, it's that, or do you look at it and go, well, actually, yes, they are 100 credits, but they are actually quite powerful. And if I take 4 of them, nobody's going to want to play me because I've got 4 Maulers. It's that. Well,
thing you have to factor into that, of course, is the actual cost of the physical model, because I think, you know, that not being a factor in it, yes, I do think people would do that. But I think also, you know, how much does it cost to go and buy 4 of them in the first place? Maybe people don't want to do that.
No, but, you know, proxies or whatever, any, you know, bits and pieces. But
sure.
I think it's probably more true with the Ridge Hauler, isn't it?
That, well, yes. I mean, Eddie did drop a lot of coin on that thing. We've got a lot of fake coin back, but no. I mean, that does seem like a big investment. And you know, and it did work out for him. I did have my issues with it. I mean, I think and again, it was a very clever combination. I think that's a candidate for the stack of whack itself, actually, because just the way that, you know, the ammo crates and the Promethium crates and all the rest of it just generate kind of this very incredibly reliable stream of income that almost makes the territories irrelevant for him.
Well, what I would say did it ruin the campaign? I mean, yes, it played to his personal narrative.
Yeah.
But did it, and certainly it helped
I think it dominates
Raiders.
I don't agree. I mean, he generated a lot of credits. He could buy some of the shiny toys he wanted in terms of, you know, equipment and stuff for his gang, but he didn't dominate the campaign by any, you know.
No, I mean, I don't mean in terms of wrong choice of word. What's the right word? Again, it became the distraction con effects of the campaign. Everyone was talking about it. Everyone wanted to kill it. It was this kind of like focal point of like, you know, it's this thing. It's the biggest thing on there. It sucked all of the oxygen I felt out of the whole thing. And a lot of my attention was put on it, probably incorrectly.
But that was also partly his narrative, though, because he came to me at the beginning. He said, look, no, as far as I can see, nobody else is going to run a Ridge Hauler. I'm going to run one. And I'm going to spend the entire campaign trying to get it as long as I possibly can. And that is my focus. And that's what he did. And that's what he achieved.
It also arguably gave Jacob his personal Necromunda highlight thus far.
Poor Jacob. That cheer that went up is still, I think, probably one of my favourite moments of the campaign. He was so happy.
Yeah, he was. I mean, he was ecstatic. I mean, I think, I don't know, I think maybe just is the way we were talking about, you know, you said, Dix, you know, try and categorize yourself about what kind of player you are. And I've thought a lot about this, you know, and
I'm really that. Just before we go into that, I'm really intrigued to hear the three of you. The three of you have very different play styles, and I'm really interested to see how you perceive yourself, because I've had conversations about each of you with other players to hear what type of play style they think you are. So this will be really interesting.
Let's do this.
So I think we should see what each of you think your play style is, hear if everyone else agrees, and then I'll tell you if I agree or not.
Who's going first?
Oh, I'll go first because I think I've got a relatively good... I mean, I like to think of myself as a narrative player, but I equally know that I'm a lazy player. And I go for... I'm constantly looking for the heart over head moment. You know, it's that I say this quite a lot, that I don't care if I win or lose. And I maintain that that's true. But what I do get is I get a bit annoyed or despondent when I feel like I'm wasting my time on something. And so I will very quickly, if I don't see it going my way, then I'm like, ah, this is over. Like, let's just call it, right? Because, and I don't like to always, you know, bottle straight out the gate, because people come down and they want a good game, but I can kind of math hammer it in my head and go, yeah, I'm not winning this. So let's kind of wrap it up as quickly as we possibly can in the most narrative kind of way possible. And the last couple of, well, especially the last campaign, I was a little bit absent from the narrative because I wasn't enjoying it at all. And so I kind of phoned it in, if I'm honest.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah. I mean, again, one of the gangs, obviously, that's close to your heart is the Redemptionists. And, yeah. You know, again, that gang is one that very much encourages you to focus on a particular very nasty weapon.
Yes.
We all know what that is.
Or a couple of them.
Or every single model. And, you know, I've gone, this is going to be an uphill struggle with flames everywhere. So there's definitely, you know, that I would say some of the stuff that you like to bring definitely is up there in terms of its competitiveness, for sake of a word.
Yeah.
But that said, I think it is true that everything you bring to the table, you've got a story behind, which is great.
Ross? Like group therapy.
I was just waiting to see whether I was waiting to see Dixie flip out his notebook, put on his reading glasses, and give the ultimatum, as it were.
What about your mother?
Yeah, what's your earliest painful memory?
Hello, everyone. I'm Dixie, and I'm a Necromunda player.
Well, it's interesting. Again, we in the lead up to this episode, it dredged up something from my dim and distant A levels of the Yohari window, which is this idea of your sense of self, how you think others perceive you, how they actually perceive you. You can tell I didn't do very well in my exams, but it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because talking about this before, I said, well, I like to think I'm vaguely self-aware. I've definitely invested narratively into campaigns previously and actually written up lore, put in contributions to the Gazette, all of this kind of stuff. This last slash, what it asked Gate, well, I did put together a draft bit of lore for my Cold Traders. It definitely felt like the campaign where I'd put least energy into kind of crafting a background, whether it was putting in bits on our you know, the Facebook group or sharing them on the socials. And it was an interesting one because I know I'm in a room full of gamers, I err towards the more sort of extrovert. I'm definitely loud and I'm definitely prone to faux outrage outbursts. So I don't think I've ever got genuinely angry. Or at least I hope it didn't appear that way. But it was interesting talking to Angus, famous creator of Pests at Home, the other day. And he said that one of our newer players had perceived that that I was quite competitive. And that definitely put me on a path of sort of self-reflection a little bit, where especially people who don't know me, who don't know that it's all bark and almost no bite at all, whether that's something to kind of, I don't know, about curb. But when I have a fit of temper, I do like to think it doesn't last very long. There's a couple of profanities and then I kind of laugh
cathartic.
It off.
I mean, I'm kind of the same, that, you know, it's out, it's gone and it's bygones and we're moving on, sort of thing.
Yeah, and certainly you and I have, there's a similarity between us, Lee, as horrifying as that might be to hear.
No, I think that's fair.
Because I'm prone to a couple of choice words, but I have never torn a model in half.
Didn't tear it in half, I crushed
it. Yeah, you did crush it.
And it was a limited edition model as well. You weren't getting that back anytime.
That poor Chaos Witch never saw it coming.
Well, should we clarify that? Have we explained?
No,
that
I don't think we have.
I think we should leave it there.
We can leave it alone for another day.
it's worth clarifying, Lee, before someone sends you around for
the TLDR. Without going into four things, we were playing Ross's Haunter in the Dark campaign, and I'd never used I think last episode I wanted to play psychic. Well, actually, I tried to play psychic with the Chaos Gangs, the Heliot Cults thing, and get this psyker. And I think it was game one or game two.
It was game one.
Very early in the campaign. I think it was game one. I think it was like turn two. The beast shows up and 66s kills the psyker. And I'd been building up in my head this whole narrative backstory about stuff, what I was going to do. And I just went, I just lost it at that point. And I just picked the model up and went, I don't care. And I crushed it. I just went, I just crushed the model completely in my hand. And I've never heard a squeak as loud as Ross next to me when he realized exactly what I'd done. And
it felt sacrilegious.
That was where we started. We should say we're playing Permadeath Necromunda. You know, hobby hardcore, go hard or go home.
That was the first mission of the campaign. In fact, pretty much the first turn of the campaign.
It was pretty much the first. It died almost immediately, and that was it for the whole campaign. My whole gang was built around this witch, and it died literally turn one of the campaign. And I just went, F this. Done. And I just crushed the model. And I felt so guilty after Ross. Ross was so visibly shaken by the destruction of this model. It was one of the floating witches from Blackstone Fortress. So I don't know that it's a limited model, but it was a not easy to get model, let's put it that way.
A rarer model.
And I felt so guilty that I went on eBay and bought another one. And it's still on the sprue. I still have it. It's on the sprue. And I might even frame it just as I bought this because Ross was really upset.
I got over it, man. It was just, it came out of nowhere. It was, yeah, it was just a complete curveball. I'm not usually short words, but I was just, just a strangled gasp came out of me because, you know, they're little plastic men, but they're our little plastic men.
I think you spent the rest of your credits for that.
I have a very sort of, not disposable, but very kind of standoffish relationship with my miniatures. If they upset me, then they're not surviving. It's also the laissez-faire-ness of I've got a 3D printer, so if I break one, I can. And this is what I should do. I've actually toyed with the idea of printing a Necromunda gang and playing Permadeath Necromunda. That if a leg injury, you hack a leg off, or if he dies, you actually destroy the model because you know it's kind of they're not as difficult to replace because they're 3D printable. And I
couldn't do that, man, because of the effort put into paint it. You know,
I have this idea of doing that. I think that's an incredibly narrative thing because I'm playing. I like the idea of playing Permadeath Necromunda. I just do
play for keeps.
So, does that mean if 166 is, I have to literally smash it with the bell?
Yeah, let's do it.
I think you should get a gavel.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Or a pestle and mortar and just grind.
In fact, you know
dust.
What? You know what? I might even do that with the next gang, the Dalak gang. The only one I have to do is find a proxy for the Spiker because I've got the legit Spiker and I don't want to destroy that because it's a lice model, it's resin, all the rest of it. But if I can find a decent 3D printable proxy for that,
I'm just going to say that if you keep smacking up the resin, eventually you might go get fragments of resin in your eye or something.
We'll do it in a controlled way. Fair enough. Health and safety noted. All the rest of it.
PPE is important.
Exactly. So, Lawrence,
my turn. I'm probably the odd one out. Actually, I probably when I put a gang together, I probably start with how I want it to perform on the tabletop because I'm thinking about how I want to enjoy the tactical pleasures of the game. I tend to retrofit a background to what I've made.
So I probably do start, as I said before, I'm definitely that end of the min-max spectrum, if that's a thing. And I definitely do. What I enjoy about the game is the tactical flexibility. It's not, you know, I can't be tabled in turn one like I can in 40K. You know, that I go you go system, really, I really enjoy that. And again, you know, some people who have played me have said, "You're hard to play against," not because I'm not sportsmanship, I would hope, but because I'm tactically challenging. And certainly, at least somebody said that to me. Again, I'd be interested to hear your opinions, guys.
I think that's fair. I mean, you are. You can. And when I've played you before, I mean, we were playing Titanicus the other day, and okay, that was a particularly convoluted, stupid thing that I did. But you could see that you were completely outthinking me, you can just see it when I play you a couple of, even, you know, the test games for Necromunda, when you at the end of the game you go, we didn't do this, and I'm like, yeah, you're right, I didn't.
Ross, what do you think?
Yeah, I thought I'd echo the same. You've got a very sharp nose for the minutiae of the rule set. So, classic example, and again, it's outmaneuvering intellectually, perhaps. Your observation with our last game in the Ashgate campaign, you had identified that the ground was obviously difficult and dangerous. I, for my part, identified how that impacted on my fighters, on my, you know, ground troops, but I hadn't thought about how a ramming maneuver would drive my vehicle into the dangerous ground and then start to trigger those tests. And that was one of those where, you know, it's inarguable that it was a very deft move. I mean, it was another of those bloody maulers.
I suspect, but, Ross, that your playstyle and mine occasionally clash, and occasionally some of our games can be maybe not as well tempered as they should be, but nonetheless,
you know. I'm a delight, Lawrence.
But no, I'm definitely a different side of that spectrum.
That was definitely the most competitive game in Necromunda I've ever played, because neither of us were pulling any punches. It was quite an interesting contrast.
And to be fair, the mission was just awful. The setup and what we had to achieve was just truly horrific. It was one of those that we should probably have both just bottled turn one and said, well, this sucks.
Which mission was that one?
Oh, I can't remember what the objective was, but the ground, basically, everything was going to kill you,
yeah,
unless you stayed on the road.
Let's not get back onto the Ash Waste and how that should be dealt with.
And then I think Ross had put down the Beast Slayer on the road. So I was like, cool, I'm not going that way.
Nice.
Nice. And then I couldn't, you know, the reinforcements turned up on a random edge and I couldn't put any of the vehicles anywhere safe because of where all of his fighters had been put. And yeah, no, it turned into a bit of a, as I said, it was one of those where, you know, if we weren't both being bloody minded, we both should have bottled turn one and said, never mind, this come back when the weather's better.
Yeah.
And I think it was a like tornado as well.
That rad waste game that we played.
That was silly as well.
I should have done that. And that was going back to my narrative thing of like, I looked at that and went, the sensible thing here, I cannot possibly win this game. I can probably not even draw it. And I should have just gone, I'm walking away. And it just felt so...
I think we'd recognised that right from the beginning.
I that's a really gamey thing to do, right?
I know, and we'd set up the table. And I said, look, you know, you've got to burst through these gates. You know, we could argue that the gates or you know, the barricades have got some kind of defence to them. But we said, no, this is for the narrative effect. Just come screaming through the thing and...
Okay, so Dixie, based on all of that, what's the opinion? Have we been truthful or not?
That was fascinating. I think I think you're broadly all self-aware, shall we say? I mean, Lee, I think you do lean into the narrative quite a lot, and you always have done, but you shoot yourself in the foot quite often as a result, and then don't enjoy the games because you have sort of put yourself into a corner where by leaning too far into the narrative you've hamstrung yourself.
Yes, I always think that this thing's going to happen, and it's like, it's that like Hail Mary thing we said right in episode one. I'm playing for the Hail Mary, and I know that is a really dumb thing to do, and I shouldn't get upset. But you want this thing to happen. It's like, it doesn't happen, and all I'm playing for are those, you know, friendly fire frame moments.
Yeah, really. But it's things like, you know, playing Cawdor and not using the faith points. And stuff like that. So,
well, to be honest with you, I mean, people say that all the time. And the last three or four games I played, I barely got, you know, and I do pick the one that needs a lot of faith points. But you know, I never get enough.
No, but then you
roll enough fives.
You only have about half the number of gangers that most Cawdor players have. So,
true.
You know, bone pickers are 20 credits for a reason. Like, there should be lots of them there, and they should die horribly in droves. But that's fine, because there are lots more bone pickers in the whatever. But
I'm playing an elite version of Cawdor. Very well.
But yeah, no, it's interesting. I think Ross as well. I think newer players who don't know you, I think that is a very good point. People who don't know you as well personally, or have not played against you in multiple campaigns, they don't recognize that the faux anger is faux anger. So that conversation you mentioned about with Angus saying, you know, that somebody had said you were really super competitive and they didn't want to play you. More than one person said that to me. but you do have those competitive moments, I think. Sometimes the anger is genuine and you don't quite realise. Like that game against Gareth with the scuttler going up over the front of the cab into the escort.
Oh, it completely blindsided
me. It did. It did.
Because there was no counter. It was a deft use of, you know, and the cards literally fell in his favour in terms of how our tactics cards were rolled out. And it was just, I just had nothing. There was no recourse. There was nothing to do with it. I was completely dumbfounded by it.
Yeah, yeah. But I think it had the glove been on the other hand, you know, and you'd pulled an equivalent thing against Gareth, I think you would have been extremely pleased with yourself.
Oh, absolutely. No shadow of a doubt.
the scream of victory, I think, would have been loud and clear. So I think that is quite interesting. But you do have, I think, you underestimate your min-max elements as well. You were bearing in mind, you were the only person who turned up at the beginning of the Ash Waste campaign with a fully scoped out map of all of the road sections and what you wanted and everything else.
I was super impressed when you did that.
Yeah, that's, to me, that's...
See, not even I did it that time.
To me, it's an interesting one, because I do... The campaign mechanics, whether it's the Outlands, whether it's the Ash Wastes, it's not... You can't, as is clearly evident, because none of my plans came to fruition, but that kind of meta gaming of the campaign mechanic, it's, you can't necessarily play to advantage. You kind of come up with a game plan. And I guess it's a weird one, because not for years, but I very much enjoy those sort of, you know, like strategic games. Lots of listeners, I'm sure, will, you know, reel them off, like, you know, the Dawn of Wars and the Age of Empires and stuff. And that kind of mechanic of the sort of settlement building or the, you know, the kind of empire building is I find those mechanics fascinating and quite enjoyable to kind of dig deep into. It's telling that it didn't. My Outlands campaign was moderate. You know, I think my settlement did just fine.
I think you definitely can do that in the Outlands campaign. Yeah. You could definitely plan an optimal settlement and have a reasonable, like, because a lot of the settlement buildings generate the resources and that possibly needs house ruling. But you can definitely do it in that one. Yeah. But I, again, because you're relying on what other people do, and also which games you get to play in Ash Waste, I'm not sure doing it in Ash Waste is so viable.
Well, it certainly didn't work out for me, although, interestingly, that there was that narrative twist that, without even noticing, I kind of have something of a grip, an iron grip on the Ash Gate itself through trade routes in future campaigns, potentially. But it's one of those interesting ones where, you know, GW put together these campaign mechanics, and I guess I really like them, the potential for kind of digging into that other level of games. So you've got the games themselves, but you've got that meta game behind it, I guess it really piques my interest. I like that side of it.
And especially, you know, any campaign that is a map style campaign is there to be played with that second level to it, right? You know, when you do a 40K or whatever map campaign, you know, you're inviting people to play the game on two levels, right?
But
and I suppose that I personally don't think there's anything wrong with it.
No. But... Well, I guess the telling and interesting thing is, as James has already kind of mentioned and I've kind of responded to, is that there are plenty that didn't. You know, whether you kind of lean into Ethan's fundamental sort of, not apathy, but indifference to the map. You know, he's there to throw some dice and have a good time on a Monday.
So Justin was another one where he simply said, you know, who deserves a kicking?
I mean, I came at it, we had to pick routes, and I just went, I'm going being completely random because I'm just going to let the fate take the redemption where it takes them. And so I think I stopped looking at the map after week one.
See, I think is a really critical point. And so I'm going to use that to springboard onto you, Lawrence. I think your self identity as the opposite end, you know, of the spectrum is apt, definitely. You are a very tactical player. And you know, there is obviously an element of min-maxing with the gang itself and whatever else, but in terms of actually on the tabletop facing an opponent, you are very tactical, which is, you know, it really is a juxtaposition to every other player we have in the club, who from some extremes, obviously, you know, Ross, Lee, you're both quite tactical, etc., but probably not to the same degree.
But then you get
the other end, people like Justin and Ethan, who just want to just, you know, run across the table and throw some dice, etc. So I think there is a degree of self-balancing to that. Let's go back to the Ash Waste campaign, Lawrence, for example, the map side of things. Obviously, you ended up with the longest continuous road section because you very specifically went after that. You know, you studied the map, you worked out what you wanted, which of the things you were going to go for, and did a lot of trading. It didn't quite go to plan, but you still ended up.
Yeah, but I did do a little bit of trading, but mostly I was just going, cool, can I play a raider and get the section I wanted? And I actually kept wanting to face off against Jack because I wanted to break a particular benefit that he had for a trade route that would also add to trade route. But because of the system that we had for who got to pick, I kept being in the middle of the table and therefore was absolutely last to pick. And I think I was forced to play Jacob once and I was forced to play Richard twice. I was like, damn it, I don't have my choice here. And as it ended up, it just didn't work. I absolutely agree.
But I think it's probably one of the important things going back to, I think it was you and Ross were mentioning earlier on. One thing that we see to a certain degree within the club is when you are playing an opponent who is not in the same mindset, let's say, as you, it's how much do you then try and help that person? Because I'm going to use the example game here where you had against Rich that we talked about in a previous episode.
Yeah.
So from your perspective, you know, absolutely perfect from a rolling dice functionality perspective, nailing that transport on the second shot of the game and winning the game immediately.
Yeah.
Great. You know, nothing wrong with that. Tactically brilliant. Perfect. From a fun perspective, awful. No fun for you. No, certainly no fun for Rich, who never got to roll dice.
I absolutely agree.
If
I'm honest, I think that's probably a bad example because the mission just
didn't. Well, the mission didn't help.
It
but
was the
it's
obvious
but,
thing to do. It was the it obvious,
the obvious
thing,
thing
to
do. But then, if you look at it, let's say again, taking a step away from the min maxing and the tactical side, if I was playing that mission against Rich as a narrative player, which I think everyone would agree I'm very much a narrative player, although I happen to be quite lucky generally when I play in a campaign every now and then. I would not have made that shot in the first place on the basis of if I hit it and it goes through, then the game is over immediately. I would have waited until later in the game to do that shot. so that my opponent would then have time to do stuff and other things may have happened, you know, and so on and so forth. So I think there's, you know, there's pros and cons to all of it. I'm not saying that min-maxing is better than narrative or narrative is better than min-maxing. They all have their place, and I think meeting somewhere in the middle is better.
Finding a happy medium.
And I think the thing that is super, super critical is being aware of what type of person you're playing and helping them to level the playing field as much as possible. So again, let's say Ethan as an example, he's there to roll dice. He's not quite so interested in thinking about the sub tactic game of the maps and all the rest of it. He may not remember certain abilities or tactics, or he may not think about, you know, if I move this person here, then will this happen or that happen? So gentle reminders throughout the game of, oh, by the way, if you do move that person there, have you considered this, or have you considered that that might happen, helps them to learn how to be a little bit more tactical and stuff as well. And I think likewise, you know, as from those who do min-max a little bit more and play more tactically like yourself, Lawrence, I think as you embed more and more into the club, you're already taking those narrative steps a little bit more than you would have done, you know, two campaigns ago, for example, which I like to see.
Yeah, quite true. I think what is also quite good, actually, is, you know, outside of campaign, we do play quite a lot of Necromunda just as one-off games or as skirmish, you know, and I actually do get quite involved with, you know, I've had some really lovely games with some of our newer players, the other Ross, you know, when he came down at first, you know, we were looking at the Ash Waste rules, and once we kind of figured out how they worked, we were talking about, you know, these are the things to try and do, and these are the things to not do. But again, you know, in campaign, not that there's anything to be had from it, but at the same time, you know, it sets up that mindset of this matters this time. Which can sometimes be quite difficult to break.
Yeah, I mean, everyone...
Okay, yes, it's a game. It doesn't matter.
Everyone wants to win at the end of the day.
Except because Necromunda, you don't actually win.
No, nobody wins. It's Necromunda. Nobody wins.
But everyone
wants to get that Hail Mary moment. Everyone doesn't like it when their opponent gets that Hail Mary moment instead, or prevents them from having their own Hail Mary moment. It's just... you know, chalking it up.
I think for me, it's the death of a fighter. You know, or you're inevitably going to get one or two, but, you know, if you lose a leader because you played suboptimally, it sucks. At least it does for me, and I don't. Maybe it does for other people.
As long as it's memorable. I mean, you know, like going back to talking about some of the things we've done in the past. You know, the Friendly Fire Freya incident, or the Enforcer falling off 9 stories and killing the guy and walking away, or, you know, my leaders being immolated and dying. You know, I remember because I do it because they're memorable deaths, and I think what I'm going for always is if I can make something memorable, whether it's against me or if I'm doing it's that I want the giggle, I think, more than anything else.
I take that. I mean, again, you know, we were talking about the deaths from this last campaign, and one of mine that died from Ross's barrage of crack grenades, you know, actually I quite laughed that one off. He deserved to die. That's brilliant. You know, but in a admittedly somewhere else, but in a previous campaign, I've had a leader die on the first shot of the first campaign.
Yeah. Yeah,
first shot of the first game to a mining laser going,
Yeah. Well, a little bit like my Psyker, you know.
And a little bit like what I did to the transport. You know, it was the obvious thing to do. I deployed badly. Kind of is what it is. At least, you know, that kind of is where I'm coming from sometimes.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think the takeaway from this is, dear listeners, because we've been rambling on for ages about this and probably a lot of self-reflection, it sounded like a therapy session, so I apologise if it sounded like it's a therapy. It wasn't really supposed to be a therapy session, it was just a kind of a thing. But actually, I think the takeaway from this is know your opponent, enemy, friend, whatever, and do, you know, because this is supposed to be a fun experience, yes, winning is important to some people, but equally what's the right way to put this?
Adapting your play style.
Adapting. there you go. Adapting, thank you, James. Adapting your playstyle to fit will actually make everyone's life a lot happier and a lot better, right? And I think that's a lesson to me as much as anything else, that sometimes, as much as I might realize that it's all over, it's time to not quite disconnect and try and play for the win as much as I know it's not going to happen.
Yeah, and it's always, I think, another takeaway is it's always courteous to, if your opponent is doing something that is an obvious mistake, or they have clearly forgotten an ability or a rule correctly, or whatever it might be, even if it puts you at a disadvantage, it's worth pointing it out to them and reminding them how it works, because, again, ultimately, it's for everyone's benefit, for them to learn more, remember how things work, and enjoy the game overall. Because that may result in one of your fighters being killed. But yes, that's sad for you, but it's also brilliant for your opponent, because they will remember killing that fighter. And it's exactly their campaign just as much as it is yours.
And Trisha, I really agree with that one, because even when you come at it from a tactical perspective, playing against an opponent who doesn't know his army very well isn't tactical brilliance. It's playing against an unprepared fighter. It's much better to, make sure that your opponent is capable of giving you a fair fight.
It takes all the fun out of the victory, I think, if you just smash somebody's gang off the table immediately. Well done.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It absolutely does.
So yeah. So I say, I think that just again touching back on that one shot vehicle one, Lawrence. Again, tactically brilliant.
I'd have to admit, I didn't intend.
No. There's an element of luck of the dice, etc.
Quite clocked on. I would have almost one shot at it, and at that point,
but. I would like to think late. That in if that situation arises again, there would be a second thought about whether you made that shot in the first place. And ultimately, as the more campaigns everyone does, the more people are going to learn and the more they're going to adapt, and everyone's going to enjoy it. I've got a steep uphill battle myself, because the one consistent issue we're having across everything is the way missions work and the way campaigns themselves are fundamentally flawed. In certain ways, particularly when you get to sort of 13, 14 players. So I am working on something to try and fix that, but it's quite complicated, especially when you've got 150 missions to pick from now.
But and maybe this is symptomatic of my mindset, I often long for a set of missions that are perfectly balanced against each other.
You can't
walk away having nothing. You can't walk away.
What I normally do in a campaign, which I didn't do in the Ashway, so I thought I'd try something slightly different, and it didn't quite work. Is I will run one mission for everybody each night. So in game one, everyone will do escort mission. Game two, everyone will do whatever mission. Then that kind of, and I try to pick the missions that are relatively balanced, so that does tend to keep it fair. Obviously, the Ashways, we did something slightly different. We had a table of missions that were generally a bit better balanced, but there is still some severe flaws in those.
In my Haunter in the Dark campaign, that obviously, which was a much shorter campaign, I took that approach of, and from an arbitration perspective, as long as you have the resources, I printed out the scenario sheets for every table where we had environmental rules, like the smokestacks, for example. I was able to cut out, I used acetate sheet and cut out those templates to go around the terrain. And for me, that was quite nice. Yeah, you haven't got the breadth of, all those various different games going on. But I think, I don't know, as a player, I quite like the idea that all our games that particular week are comparable. So you can kind of see across, four or five tables maybe, how everyone's done with the same limitations almost. I don't think it's to the detriment of the game. That would be my take on that approach.
I guess there's one side of me that says, narratively, how is everybody doing exactly the same thing at exactly the same time? But again, Ross, I think your point there is really good. Being able to measure yourself against how the other gangs have dealt with that same mission is quite interesting to see. Oh, that's how you played that and you managed to pull out a win while I lost. And
I think it's probably worth also pointing out that, generally speaking, if you think about a campaign in a wider context, the actual mission itself doesn't necessarily mean anything from the narrative perspective.
Very true.
So from purely from a simplicity perspective, arbitrating one single mission for six games one evening is significantly easier than trying to arbitrate six different games. But
yeah, especially if you get rule questions about, you know, the specifics in the mission, yeah,
especially with the weather on top of that as well.
Yeah, I mean, again, if we do Ash Wastes again, which we probably will at some point, I would probably look to do a single mission and a single weather condition, and possibly even a single ground condition for everyone each week, just to make it easier for all involved. But benefit of hindsight is a wonderful thing, isn't it?
It's always about learning and always about getting better.
In many ways, this is why we do this, right? Is to share that learning. And if we never made mistakes, there'd be nothing interesting to talk
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's a really good... I think that's a really important and salient point to almost end the conversation on. Anything else, gentlemen? I think our therapy session is... Our time is up and our therapy session is over.
That's...
regular broadcast will resume.
250 month. Credits well, each, please, for the therapy session.
Yeah, we should do. They get all. No, does the rogue doc cover that?
Yes.
There's monster.
Monster.
But yeah. you always come away with scars.
Oh yeah.
Right?
Yeah, we do. So we'd like to thank everyone for listening this month. And also Justin had to dash, so he says he really enjoyed being in the chat and the opportunity to come and talk to everyone. And he sort of says bye-bye, but, you know, he had to make a move.
Lee, just to interrupt, one final thing. From my perspective, particularly from other arbitrators, if you have a disparity between your players of min-max and narrative, how you handle it in your campaigns, I'd be really interested to hear about.
I think we would love to hear
and
that.
Also from players who have identified themselves as one or the other and made a switch deliberately to the other side. I'd be interested to hear about that as well.
Or those that are vehemently one or the other and are taking a stand on their narrative and until they die, or they're whack and they're min-max until they die, and they're unashamedly so. Would also love to hear that, because how do you integrate and how do you play and all the rest of it, and you know, are you, dare I say it, that person?
Yeah, and even beyond that, as usual, we'd love to get some more Stack of Whack submissions. If you've got any rules queries or edge cases, obviously write into Dear Dixie, and keep on sharing those posts of your hobby progress on the Facebook group, the Facebook page, the Instagram, and you can always hook up with Gareth on Discord if you want to show him some of your Necromunda goodness as well.
Yes, I'm occasionally there, but not very often. Anyway, so guys, thanks. Seriously, thanks for listening, we really appreciate you listening this far. But if you've listened this far and you didn't like what you hear, well, thank you anyway. So it's bye from me for this month.
Cheers. Bye, everyone. Don't pay attention to the ramblings of that notorious gangrene.
Notorious gangrene. Cheers, guys. Bye.
You've been listening to Gilders Ford Radio, broadcasting live all across the Sump, the Hive, Outlands, and the far reaches of the Ash Waste.